Welcome to NYU Langone Insights on Psychiatry, a clinician's guide to the latest psychiatric research. I'm Dr. Thea Gallagher. Each episode, I interview a leading psychiatric researcher about how their work is shaping clinical practice. Today, I'm excited to welcome Dr. Christopher Pittenger. Dr. Pittenger is a professor of psychiatry at the Yale School of Medicine and director of the Yale OCD Research Clinic. In our conversation, we talk about the biology and treatment of obsessive-compulsive disorder, including novel potential treatments like psychedelics, glutamate modulators, and transcranial magnetic stimulation. We also talk about why OCD is so underdiagnosed and what clinicians can do to spot it. So I'm excited to have this conversation about OCD. And, you know, we know that it's fairly common, affecting about 1 in 40 people, and yet it remains underdiagnosed. Can you talk a little bit about why that is?
Sure. I think there's sort of two broad reasons. One is that, unfortunately, we are not training our practitioners particularly well for OCD. I can speak primarily for psychiatric training, but I think that this is true in psychology training and other disciplines as well. I mean, a lot of early training happens in the hospital. Patients with OCD are rarely hospitalized, and if they are, it's in a specialty unit. And it doesn't pop up as much as it should in outpatient training either. So, and this leads to a sort of self-perpetuating cycle. It's underappreciated, therefore the trainer's underappreciated, therefore no one works to change that, except at places where there's a strong presence. You know, I'm certainly working at Yale where I teach to make sure everyone is thinking about OCD, but I don't think that's universal. So I think that when mental health professionals are evaluating a patient, it's very common for us to see a patient who's evaluated for depression or anxiety in very generic terms, not even, you know, real diagnoses. And it takes years before someone asks the right questions to get the OCD diagnosis. So I think there's a lot of work to do in professional training to just get it on people's radar as something that they need to be asking about in every evaluation. So that's half of it. The other half isn't within professional circles, but rather in society at large. And has to do with the specific, you know, the nature of the symptoms of OCD. So folks with OCD have these intrusive thoughts that make them very uncomfortable and feel unwanted, feel foreign in some way. But they almost always have really pretty good insight. They know that these thoughts make no sense. They might feel that they're contaminated and that they are in danger of starting a plague or whatever. They know that that is irrational. They know that it's an excessive fear. That knowledge doesn't do them any good. You know, that knowledge doesn't make the thoughts go away. In fact, it can be an additional source of suffering because it leads to this sense of being out of control of their own thoughts and mind. But because they know that these thoughts are irrational, because they know that the behaviors, the hand washing, whatever the attendant behavior might be, will be perceived by others as excessive, they often hide those thoughts. And this leads to an underappreciation of what OCD actually is in society at large, and for people to tend to not tell their families, not tell their providers what's actually going on, what's driving their distress. And there the answer is public education and advocacy. And this is, I'll say, over the course of my career, over the last 20 years, this has gotten better. I think there is better advocacy out there. There is a better understanding of what OCD really is.
Yeah, there's the piece of, you know, not wanting to admit to the excessive nature of the thoughts, but also the taboo nature of some of the OCD thoughts, right, sure. As well, like harming other people, harming children, things that, again, the average person doesn't really know about with OCD, right?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because you're right. Sometimes the self-consciousness, if you will, is because the thoughts are excessive or seem bizarre. But sometimes it's because they're taboo. Like, as you said, an intrusive thought of harming someone else, an intrusive thought of suicide, an intrusive thought of hurting children, or intrusive sexual thoughts. These are quite common. And so then there's the fear isn't so much that the thoughts will be seen as bizarre or excessive, but that they'll be seen as repulsive because of their taboo nature. So yeah, that also causes people to keep their symptoms to themselves and gets in the way of a proper diagnosis and treatment.
Yeah, repulsive or even criminal. I have a colleague who she went to a psychiatrist with intrusive thoughts, and he actually like called her boyfriend and said she was a danger to him after, you know, talking about these intrusive thoughts. And that's obviously an extreme example. But, you know, we thought it was like kind of a duty to warn, even though she had intrusive thoughts about harm, had no intention of ever doing it. But I think you know, like you're talking about, clinical training is really important. And you were saying, you know, for people to ask about it at, you know, for psychiatrists to ask about it at initial evaluations. Any other kind of things that you hope will happen in, is it just asking the questions, or is it like, again, having it more part of the training? What other thoughts do you have to make psychiatrists more competent with both assessing and diagnosing OCD?
Yeah, I mean, I just think it should be part of every evaluation. You know, we always ask about hallucinations. We always ask about suicidality. We always ask about, you know, paranoia or other evidence of psychosis. I think we should always ask about uncomfortable thoughts that come into your mind that are difficult to control and you wish would go away. It's easy. It takes 5 seconds. And I think that that should be part of every evaluation. And then, of course, you know, in someone with anxiety and depression, in someone, it's much easier when someone's checking all the time or washing their hands all the time. Then people will think of OCD. But that only happens about, I don't know, 60% of the time, that there are these obvious compulsions that trigger our pattern recognition and makes everyone say OCD. Just about asking the questions.
Yeah. And one other layer that, you know, comes up in a lot of the different diagnoses we're talking about on this podcast is, you know, with psychiatry, we feel pretty far behind with regard to like precision medicine or having any other ways to diagnose people other than self-report. Is there any promising research with regard to biomarkers or blood tests or other ways to kind of like assess OCD in a more objective way?
Unfortunately, as I'm sure you're expecting, the short answer is no. That we're a very long way from having biomarkers. There have been some interesting studies that have looked at, you know, brain imaging or blood tests or other things and looked to see if they have, you know, give any useful information. And the answer is almost always that no, they don't. That by far the most useful predictive thing that one can do is a good clinical interview and asking the right questions. I mean, that is, the work is ongoing. The genetics is starting to accelerate with OCD. Now, we don't have clinically actionable genetic tests for anything in psychiatry, with the exception of some causes of autism. But that will come over time. And I don't think that the genetics will ever diagnose OCD, but they may give a risk factor for OCD. And if the genetic test tells you that someone is at a 20% risk of OCD rather than the population background risk at 2.5%, well, then that's, your ears are going to perk up and you're going to be asked those questions a little more carefully. I don't think we'll ever get to the point that something like a genetic test replaces asking about symptomatology, but we may get to the point that it helpfully informs the diagnostic process. I think that's probably a little farther away with brain imaging. They're pretty robust brain imaging findings with OCD, but they're not nearly precise enough to be diagnostic. We can make statements about people with OCD as a group compared to people without OCD as a group, but we're pretty far from being able to make those statements at an individual subject level. So I think we have farther to go there.
Speaking of kind of the origins of OCD, we don't know a ton about the causes, but we do know something about the neural circuitry. Can you summarize the current understanding of what's happening neurologically in OCD patients?
Sure. There's sort of a canonical circuit that's been implicated in OCD by studies going back to all the way back to the 1980s, to the birth of functional neuroimaging. And that's the sort of organizing principle that most people thinking about the neurobiology of OCD apply. In recent years, it's become clear that it's a little more complicated than that. Yeah, surprise, surprise. But the basic idea, the early functional neuroimaging found that a network of structures in the corticobasal ganglia circuitry are hyperactive. They're too active in folks with OCD. And those are the orbitofrontal cortex. That's sort of the most robust finding. The anterior cingulate cortex, and then the caudate and putamen within the basal ganglia, and the thalamus. And if you remember the, you know, basic medical school neuroanatomy, the cortex projects to the caudate and putamen, which projects to the thalamus, which projects back to the cortex. So that led to this idea that there's a hyperactive circuit running through the basal ganglia. And it turns out that the basal ganglia modulate emotion. They also modulate habits, so things, patterns of behavior that we get stuck in through repetition. And that can be good if the habit lets you do things automatically and skillfully without having to think about them too much. It can be bad if the habit's maladaptive and you can't break out of the loop. And so this idea came up starting about 20 years ago, that one thing that's going on in OCD may be that its habit's gone bad, if you will. Now, that basic idea of the frontal cortex leading to the caudate and putamen leading to the thalamus and back again, and hyperactivity in that loop has some more recent data that supports it. We know, for example, that if you interrupt that circuit surgically, surgical treatment is used in the very worst, most refractory cases of OCD. And if you interrupt that circuit surgically at a couple different places, you can get therapeutic benefit in those about 50% of the time in those terribly refractory cases. So that's, and then we also know from some recent functional neuroimaging and using a measure not of activity or of size and shape, but of functional connectivity, of how much different parts of the brain are talking to one another, that has, you know, validated that there's abnormalities in the connectivity and how synchronized these regions are in OCD. All of this tends to get better with treatment. The hyperactivity gets, so there's accumulating, you know, there's further evidence that's accumulated over the years and decades that there's something fundamentally right about that idea. But there's also evidence for, there's new evidence for implication of the hippocampus and amygdala, which are in the temporal lobe, aren't part of that canonical circuit. There's evidence for implication of circuits in the insular cortex and in the parietal cortex, not part of that canonical circuit. So unsurprisingly, it's turning out to be a bit more complicated than we originally thought. But I think that core idea that you have this corticostriatal feedback loop that has become a little bit too active, too connected, too rigid is an important contributor to what's going on.
And you said with surgery, you can see changes here. Do you also see changes in maybe the speed of the loop with exposure and response prevention treatment or SRIs?
Yeah, well, the best literature there isn't looking at the connections, but just the activity. So yes, when you treat people with either cognitive behavioral therapy or SRIs and their symptoms get better, the hyperactivity in this circuit also gets better. And that's one of the reasons that we think that this is a difference that makes a difference. And there's a few studies that have shown that over the years. There was a nice meta-analysis in 2017 that put all that work together. It's about, ended up being about 15 studies over the years. So yes, that appears to get the hyperactivity, the neural abnormalities appear to calm down. I do want to just recapitulating something I said earlier. All of this is at the level of groups. You know, you do a group, you run some stats, you can find a difference. It's not at the level of individual subjects or which is what we would need for it to be diagnostic or prognostically useful. We're working on it, but we're not there yet.
Yeah. And with the understanding this about the neural circuitry, what does it really tell us about the nature of the disease and how does that inform treatment and ongoing research?
I mean, again, I think that at this moment in time, I have to say the short answer is it doesn't. I mean, the fact is that our treatments, the SSRIs and the medication treatments have been found through trial and error. And the cognitive behavioral therapies that are very effective came from a theory about extinction learning and inhibitory learning that isn't connected to the neuroanatomy. So as in most of psychiatry, we have these treatments that we stumble upon or develop because of a theoretical framework. We discover that some of them work some of the time, and then we kind of try to reverse engineer and try to figure out how that makes sense. So there is a lot of thinking about, you know, what is serotonin doing in this circuitry? What is dopamine doing in this circuitry? There is new research suggesting that glutamate modulating drugs may be beneficial in OCD. We've done some work in that area. So what is glutamate doing in this circuitry? But I can't claim that our understanding of the circuitry has led to the treatment ideas. It's more the reverse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of going backward through, okay, we're seeing changes happen from the treatment, but not knowing how to go the other direction.
Right. And obviously the hope is that over the coming years and decades, that situation will change, that as our understanding of the circuitry, of the genetics, of, you know, the role of learning in the development of symptoms, of all these other aspects that my group and others are actively researching, the hope is that we'll get to a point where we can generate new ideas, new theories, and then test them. And we will get to new ways to help people. But we're not at that point yet.
Yeah. And, you know, I know with SRIs for OCD, a higher dose is typically recommended more than for depression or anxiety. What do we understand about serotonin's involvement with OCD?
Yeah, the best evidence for a role for serotonin is what you just said, is that the SRI antidepressants are the best and first-line treatment, whereas other kinds of antidepressants don't seem to work, or at least haven't been shown to work. The evidence is excellent with SSRIs and with the older SRI clomipramine, but it's quite mixed with the SNRIs. like venlafaxine. And it's negative with some of the other tricyclics, with lithium, with Clozaril, with lots of other things that people have tried. It's weak with mirtazapine. It's something specific about the SRIs. So that's the best evidence that there's a role for serotonin. Now, I do have to say that sort of from a logical perspective, that's not very good evidence, because we in medicine target treatments at things that aren't the core of the pathophysiology all the time, right? The best treatments for heart failure target the kidneys. You know, the treatments for infection are antibiotics. That doesn't mean the infection was caused by an antibiotic deficiency. And so the fact that serotonin-targeting antidepressants are the primary pharmacological treatment we have is interesting, but it doesn't prove that OCD derives, you know, originally from some abnormality in serotonin. There have been some genetic studies that have looked at serotonin-related genes, and there was some early signal that maybe those contributed to OCD, but it doesn't seem to be panning out in the latest genetic studies, although our understanding of the genetics is immature and time will tell. And then there's a little bit of evidence that serotonin levels in, you know, in urine or in CSF are altered in people with OCD, but it's not consistent or compelling. Finally, there's some PET imaging studies that have looked at serotonin receptors, and there have been some positive findings, but then some non-replications. So it's hard to put together a story about, you know, serotonin abnormalities, deficiency, dysregulation being the cause of OCD. Maybe once as our understanding advances, maybe that will turn out to be true. But right now, it's hard to put together that story.
Yeah, it's so interesting that kind of putting together the story in a reverse fashion. It sounds like that's what a lot of the research is hoping to do, is make meaning of the, okay, we're seeing that SRIs work at this dose, but we don't exactly maybe know what the causal factors are there. Right. And, you know, we do have great treatments for OCD. We have SRIs and ERP, but we still know that about 25% of cases are refractory to these best evidence-based treatments. What is your theory as to why that is?
Well, I think OCD, like most of our disorders, is just very heterogeneous. Mm. I mean, the way I think of OCD, take a step back. So OCD is characterized by obsessions, by irrational or excessive thoughts that come into the mind unbidden and are perceived as distressing or, you know, troubling. And then those cause anxiety. If they didn't cause anxiety, then, you know, then we wouldn't call them obsessions. They wouldn't be a cause of distress. Then people engage in some kind of behavior to manage that anxiety. Well, that's the most natural thing in the world. If you have anxiety, you know how to make it go away, you're going to do that. And then unfortunately, that behavior actually makes the thoughts stronger. And the way that works is, so these irrational or intrusive thoughts, the dirty little secret is everyone has those. Like in survey studies where, you know, surveying usually undergraduate psychology students and saying, do you ever have intrusive thoughts that you aren't really under your control, that cause you some distress, they seem foreign and you wish they'd go away? Do you ever have those? And 90% of people will say yes. And I'm pretty sure the other 10% are lying. So what's different in OCD isn't the existence of the thoughts. It's the degree to which they're treated as powerful and important. And so when you engage in compulsions, when you take the thoughts seriously and allow them to control your behavior, you're basically confirming that they're powerful and important. And then you check, you wash your hands, you confess, you ask for reassurance, whatever the compulsive behavior may be, you feel better. That reaffirms that those thoughts were powerful. You let them control your behavior, and that reaffirms that they're powerful, which means next time the thoughts come along, which they will, they're just that much stronger. So I think of OCD as being stuck in that loop of intrusive thoughts that feel powerful and important, cause distress, control your behavior. You feel a little better, but that reinforces that the thoughts were powerful and important, around and around and around and around. Now, if you think of OCD that way, there are lots of ways you could get stuck in that loop. You could get stuck in that loop because your intrusive thoughts happen to be stronger than most people's, for whatever psychological or genetic or developmental reason. You could be stuck in that loop because you have characterological predispositions that incline you to be more likely to treat the thoughts as powerful and important. For example, perfectionism or intolerance of uncertainty. You got to have things to be clear. Or a feeling of excessive responsibility for what goes on in the world around you. these are, you know, traits that all of us have to some extent or another. They vary in the population. And if you're out on the end of one of those distributions, if you have a lot of perfectionism, if you have a lot of intolerance of uncertainty, you're likely to be less able to just discount your intrusive thoughts and move on with your day. They're going to seem more powerful and important. Or it could be that some people have more dysregulated anxiety. So the thoughts are, anyway, and on and on. I can go around the whole circle and come up with lots of theoretical reasons why someone might have a predisposition to get stuck in this feedback loop. When you think about OCD that way, it becomes crystal clear that it's going to be heterogeneous. Even if the final common pathway is getting stuck in this feedback loop, and even that, I'm sure, is an oversimplification, but that's one that I find useful. But even if that's true, there's going to be lots of different ways to get there, which makes it unsurprising that that not everyone's going to respond to the same treatments. I suspect when we understand it better, we'll be able to parse patients out. I don't know, I won't say into different diagnoses or even the word subtypes is a little complicated, but different versions or flavors of OCD that will help us predict who's going to respond to what treatment. The dream that you've brought up a couple times of personalized or precision medicine. I do think that we'll get there, but I think that the heterogeneity and the high degree of resistance to existing treatments is because patients are just so different.
Yeah, and it's interesting because having treated OCD for a long time myself, you see that it's in some ways very homogenized, the presentation of the OCD itself, like, or the same kind of fears or concerns or, you know, excessive nature or the feedback loop that we're talking about. But it seems like there's something about the individual's relationship to the thoughts where it's, like you said, maybe a greater intolerance of uncertainty or like what we call like overvalued ideation, right? They're really bought in. Because the diagnosis itself, I feel like the more I treat it, the more it sticks out pretty clearly when someone has it. But it's about, it seems like the individual's relationship to the thoughts is where we see that difference and where I run into kind of difficulty in, you know, in treatment compliance, adherence, et cetera, for patients.
Yeah. And so it's interesting, like the CBT tries to weaken the connections, like the cognitive portion is trying to attack the treating the thoughts as powerful and important. And the behavioral part is trying to weaken the connections between the behavior, the emotion and the thought, the emotion and the behavior. A different line of treatment, sort of an ACT or a mindfulness based approach to treatment is more about trying to recalibrate one's relationship to the thoughts. Right. And so I think it's in terms of what you just said, it's interesting to think about, you know, I do think that these kinds of therapy, which I think can both be very effective. I mean, the ERP, the symptom evocation and response prevention, has been better studied, but mindfulness is widely used, including in my own practice. I think that these can be parts of a treatment program, but they're fundamentally trying to do something a little different. One is about the connections between thoughts and behaviors, and the other is about the nature, the relationship to the thoughts, as you put it. And so maybe when we get a little better at parsing out different subtypes of OCD, maybe that'll be the kind of distinction that we'll be making in a systematic way when we make treatment plans for individual patients.
Yeah, and the one thing we do know is it seems to have this chronic nature. You know, most people endorse having some, you know, continued obsessions even after getting good treatment or doing really well in treatment. So I think both of these treatments really being kind of a lifestyle change in that relationship to the thoughts, that something that needs to be ongoing for the rest of their life. And I know that can be kind of overwhelming for patients. But I think for other patients, they've been like, oh, okay, this is something I have to deal with forever, hopefully to, you know, a lesser intensity at different times in my life. But realizing that these are skills and tools or medication that I kind of have to commit to for the long haul. And let's talk a little bit more about some of the medicines, especially you've been involved in studying some of these. So, and you mentioned it earlier, but can you talk a little bit about glutamate modulators and what we think is happening with OCD here?
Yeah, so just to recap, the first line treatments are the serotonergic antidepressants, the SSRIs, and then second line will sometimes go to the older drug clomipramine, which may be slightly better, certainly is better for some patients, but it has more side effects. So that's the first line. And then second line, sometimes they use dopaminergic drugs like neuroleptics. But as you pointed out earlier, we don't, you know, those together, we can get 60% of people better, maybe 70% of people better, and a much smaller fraction, much better to the point of remission. So there's a huge need for additional treatments. And some of that's psychotherapy. But on the pharmacology end, there's been interest in saying, okay, maybe we're getting all the bang for the buck we can with the serotonin system, with high doses of SSRIs. So maybe we need to look elsewhere to other mechanisms, other systems in order to find other things, other ways to treat folks who aren't responsive to the first line. And so we got interested, and a couple other people in the field got interested about 25 years ago in the idea that glutamate modulation, that the neurotransmitter glutamate may be out of balance in OCD. The reasons to believe that might be true are complicated, and it's not a clear cut yet, but there's a couple studies that have looked at cerebrospinal fluid from unmedicated patients with OCD and have found there to be elevated glutamate. There's a literature of neuroimaging studies using this technique called magnetic resonance spectroscopy, which can get a snapshot of glutamate levels in the brain. It's a kind of a messy, inconsistent literature, but there are some studies there suggesting glutamate's out of whack in the corticobasal ganglia circuitry in OCD. And there's a little bit of a genetic signal that suggests there might be some glutamate modulating genes that contribute. So it's sort of, I call it weak convergent evidence. So several convergent reasons, none of which is definitive. But together, they build this story that maybe glutamate imbalance contributes to OCD. And so what we and some others started doing about 20, 25 years ago is taking drugs that are already on the shelf that modulate glutamate and trying them and seeing if we get any benefit. Most psychiatrists aren't terribly familiar with these drugs because they're mostly developed for neurological conditions. One of them is memantine, used for Alzheimer's, and probably familiar to many psychiatrists. The one that we have done the most work on is a drug called riluzole, which was developed for amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease, which is a nasty neurodegenerative disease that has nothing to do with OCD. But it just so happens that neurologists studying and treating that condition had developed this drug called riluzole. And it works to combat excessive glutamate in a couple ways. It encourages glial cells to sort of vacuum up the excess glutamate, kind of like enhancing. It would be if you're enhancing serotonin reuptake rather than inhibiting it, but we're enhancing glutamate reuptake. It also seems to block glutamate release. So it works in a couple ways to sort of tamp down excessive glutamate. And we just started treating patients who were refractory to standard pharmacotherapy with a serotonergic med, some of them on dopaminergic meds, a lot of them in psychotherapy, and weren't getting better. We just started treating with this drug, and we saw some benefit, up to maybe, in our first studies, maybe as much as 40% of people getting some benefit. And so that's led to an ongoing series of studies. Currently, we're actually working with a biotech company, Biohaven Pharmaceuticals, that is doing a large study, not of riluzole, but of a riluzole prodrug, of a new drug that turns into riluzole in the body. And that's still that's not widely available. It's not FDA approved yet. It's still in investigation, but it's sort of the 20 years later, the extension of this work. Now, glutamate is complicated. Something like 60% of the neurons in the brain use glutamate. It's involved in almost every circuit and system in the brain. It has lots of receptors. It has reuptake. It's a very complicated system. And so there are lots of different ways to manipulate the system. Namenda or memantine works in a fundamentally different way. An over-the-counter supplement called N-acetylcysteine that we've done some work on that may modulate glutamate works in yet another way. So, and there's a bunch of other, glutamate agents out there that haven't been investigated as much in OCD. So it's an example of what I was describing earlier, where we're just kind of trying things empirically. We don't have a refined enough understanding of what's going on with the glutamate system to develop a really specific or refined hypothesis of how best to intervene. We're taking the tools we have and trying them, and sometimes with some hopeful signs.
Yeah, and it sounds like it could be really promising in the future also, because it's pretty the glutamate modulators seem pretty accessible. Like if you're saying you can get them over the counter at your pharmacy.
Well, the one N-acetylcysteine, which is an antioxidant amino acid, that's available over the counter. And it looks like, the way I answer the question is, I think it has a weak benefit for some people, maybe.
Mm.
but on the other hand, it's cheap, it's available over the counter, it's really benign. The main side effect is flatulence, which is, not fun, but is something most people can live with. And so I think there's little downside to trying it. I don't think it's a magic bullet. The other drugs that I've mentioned, memantine and riluzole, are prescription drugs. They're not as widely available.
Mm-hmm. And we're waiting kind of on the research outcomes there as well.
Yeah.
Just to pivot a little bit into, ketamine, very popular with a lot of mental health conditions that people are very excited about. So what do we know about with ketamine and OCD?
Yeah, so ketamine is a blocker of a particular glutamate receptor, the NMDA receptor. And it was found about, I think the first studies were as many, more than 25 years ago here at Yale, completely serendipitously. It was found to cause a strong antidepressant effect. And the two amazing things about it were, first of all, that antidepressant effect happened quickly. And second of all, it lasts for at least a week or two in most cases after a single dose of ketamine, long after the ketamine is out of the body. So that was a revolutionary finding at the time. And then over the last, you know, the subsequent couple decades, and especially in the last 10 years, as you say, this has taken off. People are very excited about it, and it's being used clinically. And I think it'd be incredibly effective in severe depression. I think it could be life-saving in severe depression. And it's been exciting to see that work move forward. It is a glutamate modulating drug. It works differently than the other ones I've listed. And so, yeah, the idea came up a while ago, 15 years ago, that we should study ketamine in OCD. And the two groups that have done the most work there are my own and then that of my colleague Carolyn Rodriguez at Stanford. And we've actually gotten somewhat different results. And I think it's because we're studying different patients. We did an early study where we tried ketamine using exactly the same protocol that folks use in depression in people with really bad OCD, many of them on medications, many of them with depression and other comorbidities, the sick patients who failed the first line treatments and who desperately need something new. That's the group that we tried. And it was disappointing. Those who had comorbid depression, their depression got better, and that was helpful, but their OCD really didn't to any substantial extent. And we haven't pursued it very much because that first finding was disappointing in those sick and complicated patients. Dr. Rodriguez has taken a different tack, and she's been treating patients who don't have comorbidity and aren't on any medications. So a good sort of asking a sort of proof of principle, can it help question. And she's published a study and then has some more data she's begun showing at conferences, though it's not published yet, suggesting that it can in nicely controlled studies. So it seems like it can help in her hands some people, but mostly people who aren't on medication and don't have the complications, whereas our experience suggests that in the really sick people for whom we are most desperate to find additional ways to help, maybe it's not so helpful. So I refer people to ketamine when they have bad comorbid depression, really to target the depression. I don't generally refer people who are refractory and severe to ketamine specifically for the OCD. Mm-hmm. But for comorbid depression, yeah, for comorbid depression, it can definitely be helpful.
Yeah, and it sounds like it could be another option for people with, you know, maybe mild to moderate OCD, which, you know, I think, you know, people with OCD haven't had that many options. So maybe to feel like, okay, there's something else out there.
Yeah. I mean, I don't refer those people to clinical use of ketamine yet because we have such good treatments already. The
SSRIs
for meds and the appropriate cognitive behavioral therapy. So I think it's better to go to those really robustly proven treatments first.
Mm-hmm.
rather than going to ketamine, which in my mind remains unproven, though, as you say, promising in that group of patients.
And speaking of something that people are even more excited about, and you are doing work in this area, talk a little bit about psilocybin and what we think is the connection with OCD and what your study is looking at specifically.
Yeah, everyone wants to hear about psilocybin. So psilocybin, of course, is a serotonergic drug found in certain mushrooms that creates a profound psychedelic effect at high enough doses. Dissociation, dilation of space and time, sense of boundary dissolution and oneness with the universe, often a spiritual experience, often an experience that people describe as deeply meaningful. It also appears to have lasting benefit in certain psychiatric disorders. The best data out there is in depression, where there have been two large controlled multi-site studies. Data looks pretty good in alcoholism, and then there's small studies in a number of other conditions. So, yeah, we got interested in that about 10 years ago, 8 years ago. And this is work that's really been driven by my colleague, Ben Kelmendi, who's a mentee now and now a faculty member here at Yale, who I've been working with for over 15 years. And I have to say, just like everything else, the idea came from the fact that it appears to work in depression and the fact that we talked to some individuals who had tried psilocybin, you know, illicitly and reported some benefit, and that made it look like it was worth trying. And there was also the first study of psilocybin in OCD was done by Moreno at the University of Arizona back in 2006, and he's doing some ongoing work. So there were these little pieces of evidence suggesting it might be a benefit and was certainly worth looking at. So we're doing the first placebo-controlled study of psilocybin in OCD, and we've shown some of the early results from that, and it looks promising. We're hoping to wrap up that study by in the spring and hopefully publish it before the end of next year. And then we're moving on to next study. So I'm quite optimistic. And psilocybin is exciting in some of the same ways that ketamine was, is that you take it once, you have this, you know, odd day. But then when there are benefits, those benefits appear to last for a long time, long after the psilocybin's out of the system. There aren't benefits for everyone. But when someone benefits, it appears to be lasting. And that's really exciting. If there was something that you could do once or once every 3 months or every 6 months or something like that, that would be a fundamentally new way of approaching treatment. Now, I have to say, you know, our first study isn't published yet. There's a couple other folks at Hopkins and in London and at Arizona who are also studying psilocybin and OCD. So I think within a few years, we'll have several small studies. And I'm hopeful we'll be able to move towards a big one to really, you know, pin down, does it work and for whom, for what percentage of people, and can we predict for whom? It is early days. I can't claim it's proven. I can claim that we're excited about it. We wouldn't be doing the work if we didn't believe that this could be a benefit for some people. But I can't claim it's proven yet, so I have to stay tuned on the data. But the potential, the upside, if it really does work, is exciting.
And it does seem like with psilocybin, there's this piece that I've heard about kind of through all the studies that it feels like people get some separation maybe from their thoughts or from kind of maybe their alcohol use or their depression. They kind of get this separation. And to me, that sounds like that could be a really powerful piece of psilocybin for OCD, because the thoughts feel so intrusive, so contaminating, can feel so intertwined with who they are. And maybe getting some of that separation could be part of the powerful nature of psilocybin. I don't know. What are your thoughts there?
I think that may be right. And I think it goes back to something you said earlier about the relationship of the person to their thoughts. It's interesting when we talk to folks who've come through our study and done well on psilocybin. So someone who does well on ERP will typically say, yes, I still get those thoughts. They're not as powerful as they were. I still don't like them, but now I have tools to manage them. Right? That's a success for ERP. And this is just anecdotes at this point, but what we're hearing from people after psilocybin is more along the lines of, yeah, I still have those thoughts. I don't really understand why they ever mattered so much. Right? So it's a recalibration, or I get this is just a theory based on a handful of patients' reports, but it feels like a recalibration of the meaning of the thoughts or of the relationship of the self to the thoughts, of the importance, the power and importance of the thoughts. They're still there, but their meaning, their importance has been fundamentally recalibrated. And we're doing some work, like we have long interviews with everyone. We're doing some qualitative research and narrative analysis to try to tease out these themes and get it a little bit beyond anecdotes so that we can start to develop more robust theories to try to explain what's going on and how it differs from the improvement that is seen with other available treatments.
I know you've done some work also with neurofeedback. Can you tell us a little bit about that work and what it does? You know, what's the involvement with the orbitofrontal cortex?
So this is another line of work that unfortunately is, I think, promising, but not yet ready to be a general treatment. But we're hopeful and we're still working on it. And it does go back. We talked earlier about how we have all of this, you know, this understanding of what parts of the brain are hyperactive in OCD, but that knowledge hasn't led to any new treatments. Well, so the neurofeedback is actually an example of where we're trying to get it to lead to a new treatment. I mentioned how there's hyperactivity in this circuit that connects the cortex, the basal ganglia, and the thalamus. I mentioned that the orbitofrontal cortex, which is the cortex sitting right on top of your eyeballs, is the most hyperactive. It's the area of the brain where hyperactivity has been most repeatedly, robustly seen in OCD. And that hyperactivity goes down in conjunction with successful treatment. So we asked the question, okay, we know if we treat with SSRIs or CBT, that hyperactivity goes down as symptoms get better. What if we could figure out some way to make that hyperactivity go down? Would that be a treatment, right? Sort of, could we do that causal relationship in reverse. Now, we don't want to go, you know, poking needles into people's orbital frontal cortex. Though, again, I mean, surgery is, it's not in the orbital frontal cortex, but surgery is an effective treatment of last resort in OCD. But we tried to think, is there a way to non-invasively, sort of less dramatically, modulate the function of the orbital frontal cortex? And that brought us to neurofeedback. So broadly, neurofeedback is a form of biofeedback. It's basically where I show you something about the activity of your brain on the video screen, and I say, I know that you can't volitionally control the activity of your orbital frontal cortex, right? You look at me funny if I tell you to turn down your orbital frontal cortex. But I'm not asking you to do that. I'm asking you to trial and error, see if you can figure out how to move that line on the screen. Push it up, push it down. And it turns out, and this fact is remarkable, it turns out people can learn to do that. They can learn to volitionally control the activity of their orbital frontal cortex. Not because they can sense it, because they can proprioccept the activity of the OFC, but because they're being shown it on a screen. So that's what neurofeedback is. And so what we've done, and this is work that is spearheaded by my collaborator, Michelle Hampson, also here at Yale. What we've done in a collaboration going back 15 years is we take people with OCD, we put them in the scanner, we show them their orbital frontal cortex, and we tell them, you know, try to move the line. See if you can make it go up. See if you can make it go down. Some people can't. Some people can. And when they do, their symptoms get better in a lasting way that lasts for at least a few weeks. And it also leads to an interesting, if you will, rewiring of the brain. It changes the structure of how different parts of the brain are interacting with one another. So that's pretty exciting. The problem is, and that controlled study in patients with OCD was just published this year after a lot of work. The problem is the effect is pretty small. It's pretty variable between people, and it's pretty small. And since the neurofeedback is hard, it requires lying in an MRI machine for hours, which is uncomfortable. It's hard to do. We feel like before we can start to push that out to be a treatment that might be widely applicable, we got to figure out a way to make the effect larger. And we're thinking hard about how to do that.
Yeah, kind of getting the juice to be worth the squeeze, it sounds like.
Yeah. I do want to say one other thing about neurofeedback, which is, so neurofeedback is actually a very general term. It's kind of like psychotherapy or medications, but you can do neurofeedback on anything that you can measure in the brain. What you need is a way to measure something in the brain that you think is associated with an illness, and then a way to nudge it or to measure when the thing you're measuring gets back in the direction you want it to. So in our case, we measure the orbital frontal cortex activity, and we try to nudge it back towards lower. Neurofeedback in general has been studied much more using EEG, not brain activity in an MRI machine, but electrical waves, brain waves, we're using an EEG machine. And so there is neurofeedback that's out there, and this is why I felt this was an important point to make. There's neurofeedback that's out there that you can pay people to do. But it's almost all based on EEG. And there's some evidence that it can be helpful in attention deficit disorder, in various other conditions. There isn't any evidence that EEG neurofeedback can be helpful in OCD. And the problem is, we don't have an EEG abnormality in OCD. As I said, you need to have something to measure, and you need to know how it's abnormal and where you want it to be in order to give people feedback. And we don't know that in OCD. So I have had people come to me and say, yeah, I've tried neurofeedback. It didn't work for me in OCD. But the fact is they were trying a kind of neurofeedback that wasn't designed to be helpful in OCD. So it's important, since neurofeedback is sort of up and coming, less familiar than pharmacotherapy or psychotherapy, it's important for folks to know that it's a broad generic term, and the details matter a lot in terms of what is the neurofeedback targeting and what's the method being used.
And with my last question about treatments, can we talk a little bit about TMS, so transcranial magnetic stimulation? What do we know about TMS with OCD, and is it promising, and what do we see for the future?
Yeah, so TMS is a way of stimulating the brain in a focused way using not electricity, but fluctuating magnetic fields. And so the fluctuating magnetic fields then influence neural activity, and then that, one hopes, can have some benefit. And like neurofeedback and like pharmacotherapy, TMS is a pretty broad thing, because what it matters where you stimulate, how long you stimulate, what the nature of the stimulation is. So you can have wildly different effects on the brain and brain circuits depending on how and where and when you stimulate. And that's an important thing to realize. It's not not all TMS is created equal. It was shown some decades ago that TMS targeting the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex can be helpful in depression, and that's well established that can be helpful. Turns out that kind of TMS doesn't appear to work very well for OCD. And so for a long time, there wasn't a lot of, there were some positive studies, some negative studies, but not a lot of convincing data. What's happened more recently is TMS protocols have been developed to target the deeper structures in the brain that are associated with OCD. So targeting the medial cortex, like right along the top of the head, seems to work a little better. And targeting the anterior cingulate, the deep medial cortex, seems to work quite a bit better for OCD. But that requires different hardware. The original TMS machines used for depression can't do that. They can't target the deeper structures. There are two companies out there, one called Brainsway and one called MagVenture, that have developed TMS coils that, because of that coil is a different shape and they've worked out the physics, can stimulate those deeper structures. And there's good evidence that those can be helpful in OCD. There was the company Brainsway did a sham-controlled trial that was published back in 2017 that led to FDA approval of their coil and their protocol for the treatment of OCD. So I think that when it's done properly, I have not done TMS research myself, but I've seen the data, and I'm convinced by it. I think when it's done properly, it can be helpful. What's less clear to me is when to use it. TMS is a little hard to access. It's harder to access someone who's doing it properly for OCD. This is another place where it's important to ask the right questions and make sure the proper coil and protocol are being used. And when you can access it, the standard protocol is it requires daily visits, 5 days a week, for often 6 weeks. So that's a really burdensome and fairly costly treatment. I do think that it can work. I don't know when to use it. I think that I still use SSRIs and appropriate cognitive behavioral therapy first before I even think about TMS. I don't know that they work better. Nobody's done that study. I do know that they are better proven with many studies, and they're a lot easier to access, especially the meds, obviously, are a lot easier to access for every patient. So I think there's still work to be done to figure out when the proper time to use TMS is. But I do think when used properly, the data suggests that it can help.
We've been talking a lot about this relationship even between, or maybe even, I don't know if it's a relationship or the experience of both depression and OCD with someone with OCD. And it sounds like with some of the treatments, if they target what we think is impacting depression, it can help with the OCD. We also know people who, you know, go through exposure and response prevention, their OCD gets better. A lot of times their depression gets better too. What are some of your thoughts about this relationship between depression and OCD? Because even when you were talking about TMS, it sounds like, but there it seems like there's no connection, like with the coils for depression don't help OCD. So what do you see as the relationship there with depression and OCD?
I think it's complicated. I think there's several different forms the relationship can take. And when we see patients, so first of all, I'll just, you know, confirm what you said, that it's the two do go together very often. About 40% of patients with OCD have depression. In the sort of more severe refractory patients I tend to see, that number is more like 75%. So it is common for the two to go together. It's common for, and often they get worse together, like under stress. When the OCD gets worse, the depression gets worse. Sometimes I've seen cases where they go opposite. The OCD gets better and the depression kind of expands to fill the space, and then vice versa. But more commonly, they go together. You can think of at least two different ways that could happen. And I think both are probably true some of the time. One is they might have similar causes, whether that cause is about serotonin dysregulation or glutamate dysregulation or stress or developmental experience, you know, whatever. They may have overlapping causes, and so the same cause may lead to both in the same people. Alternatively, we know that depression is often caused, triggered, or worsened by chronic stress, and especially chronic uncontrollable stress. Well, chronic, persistent, intrusive, distressing thoughts are a pretty great example of a chronic uncontrollable stress. So it's very often the case, or at least it certainly clinically feels like the case, that the depression is a result of the OCD. And in those cases, you want to, you know, when the OCD gets better, the depression often will. So that's two different ways the two could be related to one another. And I'm sure there are others that one could come up with. And I'm sure that the truth is a complex mix of all the above and varies from patient to patient. I do sort of, you get a sense when you're evaluating a patient as to whether the depression is because of the OCD. And sometimes they'll just up and tell you. They'll say, of course I'm depressed. This illness, you know, this OCD is destroying
my life. Yeah.
My life. And so wouldn't you be depressed too? Sometimes it's that. Sometimes they were depressed for years before the OCD started and it feels different and they don't fluctuate together. And it feels like a different, you know, comorbidity rather than a result. And those impressions will affect how I plan treatment in individual cases. I don't know how to do that systematically as opposed to just on sort of the hunches that you develop when you're getting to know the complexities of an individual patient's case.
Well, you know, I think we have more questions than answers, but I think it's exciting that all of this work is ongoing. It seems like at this point, we don't have a silver bullet, but keeping an eye on the literature and the research that's forthcoming, there's some exciting things that could hopefully impact treatment in the next number of years.
That's certainly our hope.
Well, thank you so much for this conversation, Dr. Pittenger, and thank you for being on the podcast.
It's been a real pleasure to spend this time with you today.
Thanks so much for that conversation, Dr. Pittenger. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to rate and subscribe to NYU Langone Insights on Psychiatry on your podcast app. For the Department of Psychiatry at NYU Langone, I'm Dr. Thea Gallagher. See you next time.